interest rates, their monthly payments, to go up. And also, there is, because the builders are not selling all the homes, there is some unemployment being generated. So those two factors, rising unemployment and the fact that, many people now cannot afford to do the monthly payments, makes some of the houses to be put in foreclosure.
Yeah.
That means that the bank, the owner of the mortgage, tells the people to leave the house and they sell it at an auction. And obviously, the price of the house will sell for a lower price. And also, builders who have not been able to sell all the houses that they developed start offering each time lower, asking every time lower prices for the homes they are offering. So now we have a process where the prices of homes starts to go gradually down. And here we generate now the opposite kind of speculation. People speculate that prices in the future will be lower. So a person who was thinking of buying a home decides now to wait because 6 months from now they will be able to pay less. And then when they see the whole market collapse and they say, definitely I won't buy now, I won't take this risk. And that precipitates the fall of the economy.
So we have a condition where a lot of people are paying more than their homes are worth and possibly walking away from their homes.
Yeah, the one thing to remember about home values is a home is actually only worth what a buyer will pay for it, regardless of what your mortgage may be. And so when you no longer have buyers who are interested, you no longer have housing prices going up because buyers won't pay those numbers anymore. So this game that was climbing and climbing and people were making money by this inflated housing prices, once they start to go down, they really start to go down because buyers won't pay that anymore. And that is really only the value of a house is what buyers will pay, not necessarily a number on a page. So that didn't help either.
Yes, that is correct.
Now, why wasn't this corrected when the prices were so high and our wages didn't keep pace with the price of homes? Can you address that at all? Why the Federal Reserve Bank didn't
Yes, actually it was the Federal Reserve Bank who should have noticed. And with the with a crisis, you cannot know exactly when it is going to happen, but you can look at the early signs and take policies that will correct that. And there were many early signs here, like they exist in every economy that is heating up like this one was. And one of the signs is that there are a lot more building permits being given than is usual. There is a lot more homes being given. And the other one is that there is a relationship between the monthly payments for a home and the rents for a home that's getting completely out of proportion.
So the homes were, the mortgage payments were a lot higher?
Yes, let me explain that a little.
Sure.
Let's say a family has two possibilities. One is to rent a home or to buy one.
Yes.
So they do that comparison. And of course, they will prefer to buy one. So a family, if they can afford it, may prefer to buy a home and do monthly payments that are, let's say, 15 or 20% more than they would have to pay if they rented the same home. Because there is people prefer to be homeowners, so everybody does. So that's usually where the range is. That
20% is normal.
15 to 20%, you see, is is high. The monthly payment is higher than the rent by 15-20%. But when it gets to 40-50%, You see, if you are at the Federal Reserve and you are observing the whole of the economy, then that's something to pay attention to. And of course, everybody was talking at the time that there was a housing boom. So the people at the Federal Reserve knew that there was a housing boom.
That would eventually bust.
That would eventually bust.
Policies were not put into place to stop that.
Yes. And at that time, the head of the Federal Reserve was Alan Greenspan. And it is his responsibility.
Absolutely.
That he didn't, let's say, institute the right policies.
Hope, did you want to say something?
Well, I think we would look back at that time and think that everyone knew we were in a bubble. We talked about the bubble all the time. Mm-hmm. We started our Monday morning meeting in that in my real estate company with talking about the bubble and looking at, you know, what the statistics were now and trying to guess. So we were a tiny little real estate group in a tiny little town, and we were looking at the bubble, you know, every day. We spoke about it at work. So obviously they knew that it was going on if we all did. So it does make you wonder, you know, why they didn't think about that.
Yes, and, you know, Alan Greenspan regularly had to go to Congress hearings where he's asked about the general state of the economy. And when he was asked about that, he would say that no, that in his opinion, it was not an excessive housing market, and that our financial markets today, these are practically literal words from him, our financial markets today are very sophisticated, and they are able to spread this risk.
If you want to join our conversation, feel free to give us a call at either 427-3772 or 469-3119. We're talking with Ernesto Munoz, and he's an economist from Argentina, and Hope for Peace, who is in the real estate industry for a number of years. And again, it's Free Radio Santa Cruz you're listening to, and if you want to make a donation to us, please do so at P.O. Box 7507 Santa Cruz 95061. Feel free to call in if you want to talk about the economy, how it's impacted you, if you're about to go into foreclosure. Feel free to call in.
All right, so retaking the subject, what the Federal Reserve should have done is raise the interest rates.
Yes.
Raise them by, let's say, 2 or 3%.
So some individuals were making a fortune.
Correct.
There's a lot of money somewhere floating around. And
yes, but also, it regarding what you are saying, the question comes, how come that the lenders lent money for those mortgages that ended up being bad
that
mortgages?
That was my next.
Right, right. And so we gave a first explanation that they were not local people. The local people who were generating the mortgages were selling them very quickly to larger investors. And in general, in the past, large investors were not interested in buying mortgages because they are not interested in buying a mortgage for $200,000 or $300,000 in a home. It's too small for them.
Sure.
So a new phenomenon appeared, and it was people, usually investment banks, that started creating very large bundles of mortgages. They would create a bundle of 1,000 or up to 10,000 mortgages, everything together.
Bankers. Mm-hmm.
The bankers. And those bundles are securities. Mm-hmm. It is a paper that represents that many mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And they are called CDOs, collateralized debt obligations.
That's CDOs.
Collateralized debt obligations.
Okay.
So that were packages of mortgages.
Yeah. So now they could sell those bundles to large investors, even in the United States and even abroad. So those mortgages, maybe a mortgage from Watsonville, is now in the hands of some investor in Australia.
Well, what a racket they had going.
during the time
they couldn't lose.
Yeah.
They took the risk on and they sold it.
And they got paid well at the time.
Bonuses.
Because the bottom line kept looking better and better and better, even though it was connected to
artificial.
Something that was about to fall.
Yes.
And they knew that. But I know when I had my mortgage for about 5 years, it switched hands four times. It was sold four times in 5 years. I'd just get a letter in the mail, and it would say, here's your new address, and here's your new mortgage owner.
I've heard of that,
so
too.
We were used to it. It seemed very normal.
So how were these bundled up and sold? Because I know that Standard and Poor ratings were often AAA, and if
right.
you had potentially the subprime mortgages where the
yes.
interest rates, the teaser rates that were initially offered were about to expire, and much higher interest rates were about to be charged, that was the bottom that was going to fall out. And
right, yeah,
no
yes, that's a very clear insight on what happened, you see. The people who created these bundles or
yes.
CDOs made a very complicated instrument. They cut them in sections. Usually they made three pieces out of each bundle that they called trenches.
Tranches.
Yes.
T-R-A-N-C-H.
It's a French word.
All right.
Tranches.
Thank you. And in the first and second tranche, they put the better mortgages.
They put what?
The
better
oh,
mortgages.
Double
the
A's.
30-year.
Yeah.
The solid,
non-subprimes. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And in the third one, they put what they consider were the lower quality mortgages. So, the better mortgages were going to be able to get a better rating. But they even reinforced that, guaranteeing the first two tranches with the monthly payments of the third tranche.
Oh, that was bright.
That had the bad quality mortgages.
So that was the collateral of a sort, the third?
It is like a second tier collateral. The first collateral is the house that is backing the mortgage, you see. But now there is a secondary collateral that is the mortgage on this other house where the monthly payment is going to guarantee the monthly payments if the monthly payments fail in the first tranches.
Yet the
so what happens if the monthly payments fail in the third tranches?
That is the question.
Which is
here we are.
Yes.
Because they were worthless
right.
by and large.
Yeah. We know now. We know now. We didn't know then.
Mm-hmm.
So by doing this, the mortgage banks, the mortgage brokers were able to get a high quality rating in the first two tranches. They were able to get what is called a AAA rating or prime rating. And the third tranche, the lower quality, that's even guaranteeing the other ones, that is at the higher risk, got a B rating.
B rating?
A B rating, and that was not a prime rating, it was a sub prime rating.
So
that's
mm-hmm.
where the name subprime originates.
So the investors were not free to simply purchase AAA bundles. The bundles came with AAA mortgages as well as B rated.
No. You create the bundle
yes.
to be able to guarantee one type of mortgage with the other. But then you can sell the tranches separately. So let's say a mortgage banker creates
yes.
these three tranches.
Yes.
And he's able to resell for a very good price the first two tranches because they have a prime rating. And the third tranche, the subprime, he either keeps it to himself because he cannot sell it, or he can sell it to a very risky investor. All right. But now, in the whole bundle, everything has been mixed up.
Sure.
The good with the bad is mixed through this process of guaranteeing one tranche with the other tranches.
What an unstable mm-hmm. deck of cards.
Right.
The wind could come and certainly blow that away.
Yes,
it did.
Yes.
It did.
And at the time, they thought that that was a way of spreading risk. That's what Alan Greenspan would allude when he would say, oh no, but today we have very sophisticated instruments with which we can spread the risk.
So it's very complicated.
They made something very complicated, but the bottom line wasn't there.
The fundamentals
were not there.
So they created something that was very sensitive to housing prices falling, but
right.
they called it stable, even though they knew housing prices were going to fall.
We know now, and at the time, let's say, it's not easy for people who are very excited investing in a market to notice, because after all, there is some investors who finally bought mm-hmm. those collateralized debts.
They were not.
And obviously, they didn't know that it was going to to fall down.
It's much easier to see in hindsight.
Right.
Yes, it is.
Right.
That's true.
Yes.
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 Now, why didn't Standard & Poor's come out more about the B ratings? Why
exactly.
were they so quickly
exactly, exactly.
to grant the AAA ratings?
Yes.
I've always been
yes.
confused by that.
Exactly as we say that Alan Greenspan failed to raise the interest rate, you know, before all this happened, a rating company like Standard & Poor's should have been more careful in looking at the mortgages
they were
rating high, you know. And the answer to that question is, guess who is paying Standard & Poor's to do this?
Oh, boy.
And the one who is paying Standard & Poor's is the one who has created the CDO, the one who's interested.
Banks.
Exactly. The investment banks, they are interested in getting a good rating, and they are the customers of Standard & Poor's. So, and that goes to a broader question. And that is that during 20, 25 years, a whole mentality was generated about the goods of the financial system and how sophisticated they were, and how you had there the brightest people were going to those jobs. So it was an environment where nobody dared to distrust other people. And
so
of course, now that everything fell, everybody is distrusting everybody.
Mm-hmm.
There was a sense that everything would continue as it had been. The money was easy. It would always be there to come by.
Mm-hmm.
You could sell the risks abroad.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I understand a lot of our bailout money had to go to Europe, basically, to pay off the lenders in Europe.
Yes. Some of the help that was given to AIG, for instance, was used to pay swaps from the Central Bank of Germany. No, the main bank of Germany, not the central bank, yes.
Can you explain what swaps are? These are credit default swaps. I keep hearing that term. And
yes. Swaps are insurance company. It is similar to an insurance that you can take in a house. And that is, in theory, a form of spreading risk. Let's say, if in a whole area, every home has an insurance, and you have 100,000, 200,000 insured homes, let's say, in the Bay Area, a few of them will burn. But the cost of replacing, rebuilding that home will be paid with all the premiums that the other homes are paying. So that is a way of spreading the risk. So if we say, well, then a swap is an insurance, wasn't the risk spread? And what I should say about that is that because these CDOs, these bundles, were so intricately connected,
mm-hmm.
and because all investors had jumped into this speculation because it paid the best interest rates, instead of spreading the risk, okay, the fire just spread to all the homes. It worked the exact opposite of what it was supposed to prevent. So it was like,
it's a great analogy.
Right. Mm-hmm. It was like all these sophisticated investors built a metropolis on quicksand. So yeah. When the Tsars started shaking, no matter mm-hmm. how strong the building appeared to be, the building collapsed.
And so this was an insurance policy taken out on the possibility of major defaults or a default
yes.
on the payments. I'm just trying to understand this now. So premiums were paid.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they defaulted, so the insurance company was left basically holding the bag, similar to AIG, or
yes,
is that what you're saying?
AIG was an example, yes.
So they couldn't possibly make the payments on so many
right,
defaults.
Right, yeah. So of course. That is, let's say, the explanation is even a little bit different.
Sure.
The explanation is that AIG, for instance, was an insurance company, and there was this exciting situation going on in the mortgage markets. So they found a way to get into this.
Oh, they wanted to be a part of this.
Right. So they are the biggest ones, the ones we know, but they started offering these
that
swaps. Right.
Burning.
Yes. But also, not everything was in swaps. There were a lot of CDOs that were just exposed by themselves. So probably many of the swaps were about some subprime mortgages, the ones that were going to, they were more risky, you know.
I see.
The broker banks that had them, they know, this is burning our hands, so AIG comes here to offer swaps, so let's get them. You know, and it was a market that was and still is completely unregulated. The swaps were contracts that were done just on the phone, and they didn't get registered anywhere. They didn't get controlled by the Securities and Exchange Commission or the future markets, etc.
And that was why they couldn't call them insurance, because they weren't regulated and they weren't required to have that money in reserve. To be now, when you have insurance, you have to have that money in reserve. When you sell your insurance policy, the company has to hold that money in reserve. But
yes.
For swaps, you didn't have to have the money in reserve. This is why it was difficult when we sold $60 trillion worth of swaps. We didn't have that money in reserve. Do you think that played a part?
Yes, that is a very clear and very important explanation that mm-hmm. for purposes of describing, I
yes.
said insurance, but legally, let's say, they were not insurance and they were not regulated, you know, by the entities that regulate insurance companies. So AIG, which is an insurance company, was able to create this back door, okay, that wasn't going to be noticed, you see, and it happened in a subsidiary that they had in London. That's where their particular business for for AIG happened.
Hmm.
And Chairman Bernanke, in a couple, two or three instances, has talked about how upsetting it was that AIG was doing this, knowing that they were using a loophole in the law that was not going to be controlled. But still, they gave them $140 billion to save them.
Mm-hmm.
You see,
mm-hmm.
a lot of complaint, but the money still went there.
Mm-hmm.
So this all started to unravel. People couldn't pay their mortgages. Construction started to decline. Went into commercial real estate. And now many are unemployed.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just looking at where we are today, and now the credit card industry is about to collapse, it looks like. People are defaulting on their credit cards.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. That's right. Because
I know Obama was meeting today with some credit card companies, and just different policies are apparently going to be put in place.
Yes, there is still more shoes that are going to drop, as I say.
Yes.
And what happens is a recession can generate in other sectors of the economy. But when it gets the starting point in the housing sector, what happens is that it spreads quite rapidly to the rest of the economy. And the reason why is because if you have bought a home, mm-hmm. and your monthly payments start going up, mm-hmm. you don't want to lose that home.
Sure.
It is the biggest investment you will do in your life. So you start cutting expenses everywhere.
Yeah.
You see, you cut everywhere, just spend the minimum in food, you know, and so that you can still keep on with that monthly payment and not lose the home.
So it's important that our economy is two-thirds consumer spending.
Right, yeah. And that this makes the reduction in demand spread very fast
mm-hmm.
to all the rest mm-hmm. of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it started slowly, because all recessions start tilting slowly.
Yes.
But then once the force starts happening, mm-hmm. it happens very rapidly.
And it yes. certainly did.
Yes.
Well, it's really been about the last 5 to 6 years that swaps and securities and subprimes have really come to the forefront. So it's taken us maybe 5 or 6 years to set up the whole House of Cards. Potentially the House of Cards sort of fell last September, was mm-hmm. maybe the crux of it with Lehman Brothers. So we're about 6 months into this so far. So we're really just sliding down the top of the wave right now, possibly.
So would you
yes,
agree with that?
The first signs, let's say, that the Fed should have noticed was that in 2006 is when foreclosures, okay, started to really raise beyond normal levels. After the collapse of September, there came studies that showed that the recession had really started by the end of 2007.
Yes, that's
mm-hmm.
true.
And yes, mm-hmm. and September is the sudden collapse of the stock market.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But we tend to pay too much attention mm-hmm. to the stock market,
mm-hmm.
and which is important, mm-hmm. but not to the other sectors of the economy. Like, for instance, now, the stock market started to grow, and it has gone up about 20%. And that is taking on the noobs, like saying, oh, we have reached the bottom, the economy is starting to recuperate.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just one element and could be something very speculative, you know, that could falter in weeks from now.
And
nobody can know about that, but there is other signs that are more important, which are the most important one is the unemployment rate. Because that is more than any other index in the economic, that is the index of suffering. That's the one that mm-hmm. tells us how many people are suffering in the country.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and how much the whole economy is, stalled. Yes.
Very much.
Yes.
I'd like to know a little bit about Obama's economic team, Geithner, I know Summers and Rubin are advising him. Do you have any opinions as to, they were on the Clinton team, I know.
Yes, well, first thing that I would like to talk about the Obama administration is that the stimulus package that passed through Congress is a very good policy
mm-hmm.
and is going to have a positive effect in the economy. Those are $731 billion that are going to go to stimulate work, to pay for health, to pay for education, and that is something that is very important to get the economy back on track.
seems to be trickling down now.
Right. It will take. It will only start showing its effect by the end of 2009.
I do have an exciting story about that, though, if you don't mind if I share it
really
quickly.
Yes.
I have two teenage boys, and I got a letter in the mail this week offering them summer jobs through a program from the Reinvestment Act of 2009.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So I have seen it in my mailbox, yeah. And my children are going to have jobs through that, which is really spectacular for them. So, so it's coming a little bit. I know it's slow, but in 3 months, that's not bad progress.
It isn't at all.
Money has already reached the States, and they tried to give the money to projects that were shovel ready to be started.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of it is happening already. I would say a lot. Some of it is happening already. But the bulk
but
of the effect will be on 2008.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Now, are those children being offered the jobs through what, AmeriCorps? Do you know what is it?
It's a specific program that's just new, actually, in this Reinvestment Act, and I don't remember the name of it.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
You have been interested, you know, so that maybe other young people can know about it.
I was
reading about it. You bet. Mm-hmm.
In City on a Hill, and The Sentinel had an article as well.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Yes, I would check it out.
Mm-hmm. I know the due date is Friday.
Yeah, I think it's in Watsonville, actually. It's great.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When did this whole system of checks and balances and tight regulations start to unravel, and is that one way of getting back on track? I know when I was young, we used to go to the savings and loan bank, and I felt so proud bringing in my first check, and I met my aunt at the bank, and now young people, well, a couple of years ago, they were given credit cards,
mm-hmm.
and that was
a mark of growth.
I remember savings and loans, and they were pretty much dismantled in the 80s, and we had commercial banks and investment brokers. And
yes, that is correct.
How was that dismantled, and is there a way of getting back?
Yes, during the Depression, where so many banks collapsed.
1930.
Yes, new laws were passed, and it was basically created a system with three tracks. In the first track were the savings and loan, which were very old companies. They existed since the 1980s. And they were similar to co-ops today, very local groups of investors that receive deposits from the people around. And with those deposits, they lent for people to build houses, and their business was local mortgages. So they were very careful about whom they gave a mortgage, because they had to keep those mortgages. They couldn't sell them. Okay. And they also knew their community very well.
Mm-hmm. They wanted a return on the investment.
The second track were the commercial banks that had been the origin of the collapse of 1929. And we decided to give a guarantee to the deposits in those banks. So today, the deposits up to $250,000 are guaranteed. That means that if the bank folds, people are going to be paid by the federal government. And because we were helping the banks that way with a guarantee, then we put rules on how they should operate.
What were those rules?
And the most important to talk about now is that those banks could only give individual loans and loans, commercial loans to businesses, short-term loans for the businesses to be able to buy their merchandise, pay the wages for a while, etc. Loans that usually go for 6 months or a year. Most of them are called lines of credit. So that second track was very heavily regulated. And then there was a third track, which was the investors that then became investment banks. And those people are the ones who could invest on stocks and bonds, and they would take their own risk to earn money or to lose money. And by acting separately at the bank, that their losses could not spread to the rest of the system.
I see. So they were basically contained.
Insulated.
Right.
Yes.
They were insulated. These three tracks were insulated one from the other one. And
when was that dismantled?
Yeah, that's what is called the process of deregulation. And that started in the 80s with the savings and loans. There would have been time for me to describe what happened.
Sure.
And then the, particularly the commercial banks, that saw that the investors, then became investment banks, were doing such a good business, they started to put pressure in the government to deregulate them. But every attempt they would attempt to, it was called the Glass-Steagall Act that they wanted to have repealed.
The Glass-Steagall Act?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Mm-hmm. But every time they would present a project of law in Congress, it would probably pass the Senate, but the House of Representatives would reject it and keep the act still in force. So they started chipping at it slowly. And a very important person having a role on deregulation was, again, Alan Greenspan. And then finally, in 1999, the act was repealed, and there was no distinction between commercial and brokerage banks. Everybody could do everything.
Was that pressure on the legislators to repeal it from the, where was that pressure coming from to have it, who was lobbying for its repeal? Do you know?
Yes, well, of course, they are the bank lobbyists, and they tried, let's say, I think during a period of 20 years,
wow,
they made 12 attempts at passing a law to repeal. And they spent millions of dollars on that. And finally, they succeeded in 1999. At the time they succeeded, the major exponents of their lobbying effort were Alan Greenspan in the Federal Reserve, and Secretary Rubin, who was Secretary, Treasury Secretary for President Clinton. Yes.
So both, I'm sorry, you were saying that both Rubin and Greenspan were in power at that time.
Yes. They had the two more important jobs.
He was the
and
Treasury
Summers
Secretary.
At the time was an assistant to Secretary Rubin.
And there, and what is Rubin's position now? Does he have a position in the Obama administration?
Well, no. After the Clinton presidency, when he stopped being the Secretary of the Treasury, he became the CEO of Citigroup.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So you can see the line.
Do you know what he's doing now? Is he still?
He resigned recently, but. Probably because of all these events. But he's still a very influential person. And Secretary Treasury Geithner,
yes,
is supposed to have, let's say, followed his career.
Under the tutelage of Rubin?
I don't know if I would say that, yeah, but he is connected in some way. Yeah, he's connected in some way. But his immediate post has been at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. The one who's been more connected to Rubin is Larry Summers.
Mm-hmm. And he's now an economic advisor
to the
Obama,
president, yes.
But more of a, not official, isn't it? An unofficial advisor? I really am not sure.
Yes, it's part of the Council of Economic Advisors. What happens is in that position they don't have the capacity to make regulations or name personnel, etc., like the Secretary of the Treasury. Okay, their influence is more ideological.
Well, this concerns me then, because they were in part responsible or knew of mm-hmm. this deregulation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So if they're now making the policies, I wonder how concerned they are with truly rectifying the situation. Deep house cleaning, shall we say.
Yes.
New policies.
Yes.
Tighter
that
regulations.
Is, right. That
of
is
our market,
something that is very much in doubt
monetary,
today.
Fiscal
yes.
policies separating.
Right.
Them.
Yes. Yes. I was talking about the stimulus plans.
Yes.
And in my opinion, they are going to be very effective.
I agree with you.
It is apart from the large stimulus that Congress passed, there is also the home affordable plan to help homeowners reduce the monthly payments. That is going to be effective. And there is also a plan by the Federal Reserve to help give loans directly to businesses or credit card holders or student loans. And those three are plans to stimulate the economy. Now, what is being this
underlying economy, the underlying structure and foundation, is that being addressed?
Yes, because since individuals are consuming less, the government has to take their place. So, during these next 2 or 3 years, a lot of infrastructure work is going to be done in roads and retrofitting homes to make them a more energy efficient, or repairing bridges or transportation, and that's going to be very useful to the economy.
It certainly will be. And Hope, did you have something you wanted to say?
Well, it seems like we did build really a house of cards, and I loved your illustration about building on the sand. That really made so much sense. And looking at it in hindsight, we can see that because we didn't have regulation, that caused us a great amount of difficulty. So now you would look at that logically and think, well, we need regulation. The catch-22, it seems, that we're in now is the system that we had, although it was broken, was the lifeblood of our country. And our financial systems, and potentially the lifeblood of the financial systems of the entire world. And so to try to go back now and regulate that will, quote unquote, stem the growth in some way. It's going to affect the ability for the economy to grow at the pace that it did before. The pace that it did before was maybe too much. It was growing at more like a turbo speed that was not sustainable, possibly. And so that level of high growth that we had in the last 5 years, which was connected to deregulation, potentially, because that growth was, I've heard, 2/3 of our growth was connected to the housing industry over the last 5 years. And that statistic I'd love to get on paper, but I heard that on a radio show one time. And so now we're in a position where we have to decide how we're going to fix this problem. Of course, people want to have regulation because we think that's what's happened before. So there's this sort of argument going on now. Ernesto, I'm interested in your idea on that.
Yes, well, that could be the subject of entire
a new talk. We'll have to have
but,
you back.
Let me tell you the basics.
Okay.
And in my opinion, the system can work having the commercial banks and the investors separate. But I will address the issue about homes. And the home is a very large investment, but the person who owns a home can not sell the home because he sees the prices going down and gets scared about it. The same what happens with the same person, if they own shares in the stock market. They see the prices going down, they sell the shares. 6 months from now, the prices in the stock market start going up, they buy the shares again. A homeowner cannot do that, cannot sell his home, move away, and 6 months from now, buy the home back because the prices are going again. So that market really has to be separated.
That makes sense.
There is no argument to pretend that because the they take so much part of the economy that they should be given to the hands of speculators.
So it's only been, if you mind if I ask you again to recap, it's only been how many years that mortgages have become part of our investment structure? How many years ago did that start? You mentioned it, but...
Yes, basically it happened in the late 80s with the collapse of the savings and loans. Mm-hmm. Half of them were closed. The other ones became banks. And... at that time, it cost the taxpayer $150 billion.
We always get stuck with the bill, don't we?
Right, $150 billion to solve that mess. Mm-hmm. This one will cost a lot.
Well, maybe we can learn from it this time.
Hopefully. Are there any web pages we're going to have to say goodbye pretty soon? We have to move on. But I want to ask you, are there any web pages that you could refer, any websites that you could refer our listeners to or information that's readily accessible to help them understand a bit more of what's happening? And there's so much.
Yes. There is two economists that I follow regularly. One of them is Paul Krugman.
Paul Krugman?
Who publishes in the New York Times every day. And then from what he says, he usually has references, and I click into the references and start navigating, getting more notes. And the other one is Nouriel Roubini, a professor of economics in New York.
Roubini.
How do you spell R-U-B-I-N-I?
And he has a website called RGE Monitor.
RGE Monitor.
It is a little more difficult to read, but he brings news and opinion from around the world.
And then Paul Krugman, K-R-U-G-M-A-N of the New York Times.
That is correct. And he's in the opinion section of the New York Times.
And I also have one that I can suggest to people.
Sure.
I did a really short article called A Clear and Logical Explanation of the Financial Meltdown, and it just tries to put the whole meltdown into four paragraphs that just anyone could read and kind of get a good, broad, working picture of what's going on. And you can find that at newsvine.com. That's newsvine.com, and it's Salem Sage, S-A-L-E-M-S-A-G-E, .newsvine.com. And that's where you can find that article. It's called A Clear and Logical Explanation of the Financial Meltdown, which is something that we all need.
Yes.
And we're happy to have today. We've made good progress.
And a question just came to my mind. I know that a lot of banks are now trying desperately to pay back their TARP money. And I'm wondering if you could give us any insight into why. I know that they're being charged a lot of interest on this money, and apparently the administration of the government, Treasury Department, I'm not sure which department, is looking at their applications to return the money. They may not even be able to.
Yes.
Do you know?
I wouldn't say it is a lot of banks. It
yes.
is a few.
A few.
That we are in good shape, but we are, in a certain sense, forced to take the TARP money so they wouldn't make the other ones look bad.
Ah.
The more notorious case is Wells Fargo, who received $25 billion, and at the moment that they were offered by Secretary Paulson, they said, we don't need the money. But they said, well, you better take it because you will make the other ones look bad, and depositors will run to your bank and take the money away out from the other banks.
Do you think that's why that they have posted a gain recently to try to prove that, even though that gain is really just on paper and we potentially don't believe it's actually true, the stock market didn't like it?
Yes, but Wells Fargo is still supposed to be in better shape than the other ones. And the other ones who want to return the money are smaller banks and who don't want the restrictions on how much they can pay the CEOs, and who also don't want to pay the interest rate on this bailout money.
Do we feel bad for banks that have to pay high interest rates? I don't think so.
I don't
Well, right now the money they receive from the Federal Reserve is practically interest. It has zero interest.
Mm-hmm.
But the bailout money can be from 5 to 8%.
Mm-hmm.
And that is
the one that is
that's why they want to pay that one back. Right.
Well, I guess if we feel want them to be healthy, then we don't want them to have high interest rates. But for our own vindictive nature, maybe we don't mind it if they have to pay high interest rates.
Right.
I know. I sometimes feel that way. Ernesto, you have given us such a clear outline and timeline of this economic collapse and quandary that we're in, depression. It's been real helpful, and I want to have you back, and maybe we can veer off into some other aspects.
Yes, we could talk about the other aspects of the recession, which is so wide and there is so much to say about it.
Maybe we're going to get out of it would be a good one.
Yes, we just scratch the surface of that one. But Ernesto Munoz, thank you so much
for coming on. Thank you for inviting me. Yes.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Sure. And one moment, and we're going to be speaking with Megan Cady, and she's from Free Press. She's on the line now, and we're going to be learning about the collapse of journalism in our newspapers and how that's been impacted by the economy as well. So one moment. Well, the last of the Mohegans are our theme today, and I want you to know that they're still very much alive and well. And now we're going to be speaking with Megan Cady. She is a campaign coordinator and blogger for Free Press. And Free Press is a national nonpartisan organization, and it's working to reform the media through education, organizing, and advocacy. And they're promoting a diverse and independent media, which is what we need. It's who we are. And that's, again, why we'd like you to contribute to Free Radio Santa Cruz, P.O. Box 7507 Santa Cruz, PayPal donations at www.freakradio.org. Okay, let me put Megan on now. Let's see. Megan?
Yes.
Are you on now? Let's see. Great. Okay. We're listening with Megan. We're speaking with Megan Cady. And I was reading the webpage, Free Press webpage, and I came across an article by Ben Scott. He's the director of Free Press, and he was talking about the collapse of the newspapers. There are so many lately. And may I quote what he said? As the largest public interest organization in the country working on media policy issues, Free Press has a strong interest in the future of journalism and the vibrancy of the news marketplace. The crisis in the newspaper business is often portrayed as if it were monolithic, a common disease that is affecting all newspapers alike. But this is not the case. There are several major problems hitting different parts of the news industry in different ways. One is the debt load carried by many large newspaper companies that pushes them toward bankruptcy. A more general problem is a decline in print circulation and advertising revenue as readers shift to the Internet. The technological shift reflects a demographic change in news readers as well as the availability of competing sources of national and international news online. Megan, what can you say about that?
Well, yeah, that's exactly dead on. And I'm sure that so many of your listeners have been seeing so many newspapers crumbling in the last few months. And there are literally thousands of reporters and other parts of the news team that are now out of jobs and out of work. And there are multiple reasons why this is happening. And the reason that a lot of the public think this is happening is that, oh no, these newspapers just can't support themselves. They're not making enough money. But like our policy director, Ben Scott, says, a lot of these newspapers actually are turning a profit, but they just aren't turning a big enough profit for Wall Street. And unfortunately, this is what happens when we have big corporate owners of our newspapers. Over the last several decades, we've experienced a huge amount of media consolidation.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what that means is that a very small number of corporations start to own all of the media in the U.S. And they're not necessarily buying up all the media because they have a hunger for spreading, you know, democracy and quality reporting. They're seeing the news as a commodity and a way to make money and make a very big profit.
Mm-hmm.
So they're gobbling up as many media outlets as they can to make a very quick buck.
Mm-hmm.
But they're actually going further and further into debt as they do this. And so some of them are unable to get out of that debt. Others are still totally fine, but they aren't turning the profit that their stakeholders on Wall Street want to see. And when that happens, they are more beholden to their stakeholders than they are to the public, despite the press supposed to be acting in the public's interest.
Mm-hmm.
So then you see these corporations, at first they started shutting down foreign bureaus to cut costs. That's one of the things that they started doing in the beginning. And now you can see that we hardly have any foreign reporting. And then slowly they started kind of cutting on the periphery in their newsroom. And then they started slashing copy editing jobs and even outsourcing some of these jobs to other countries, which
mm-hmm.
is a really interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, it is.
And then just you know, really shuttering down whole newspapers so that they can either make the profit they want to see or try to get themselves out of debt. And that's really troubling.
I know, I understand. Well, Seattle, I think the Seattle Post-Intelligencer or the Seattle Times recently closed, and all of their news is now online.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, that's a big problem. So many people think, well, okay, you know, so newspapers have gotten themselves into this mess, and maybe it's time that they faded away because so many people aren't reading newspapers anymore, and we should just kind of let them burn in a way. And it's kind of easy to feel a sense of righteousness as newspapers across the country, you know, have crumbled under a greedy business model that put profit before quality journalism. The problem with just thinking the Internet is going to save us is there, too. There is not a strong advertising model or profit structure on
mm-hmm.
the web that allows for the same type of quality reporting that we used to see. No one has figured out or monetized the web in a way that actually supports investigative reporting, quality journalism, and
mm-hmm.
the real type of journalism that we need to see are reporters being watchdogs
mm-hmm.
so that we can try to have a vibrant democracy and a robust press.
And also, some stories that I've come across, I've done some research into them, and their facts are incorrect.
Exactly.
And there isn't the same watchdog.
Right. And there's you know, and that that's not necessarily just the internet. There, that is happening across the board in pretty much every arena of media right now, because media is so poor and they're not being accountable. And they're basically, you know, the very core elements are of journalism are being lost. So we're not finding the kind of accurate, vetted, investigative reporting that we actually need. The reporting that we're getting now...
Entertainment.
It's entertainment. You're exactly right. It's sensationalistic. It's very cheap to produce. You know, instead of seeing something about the economy leading the nightly news, which the press has really failed us on, we're seeing things like, you know, Susan Boyle, the latest UK sensation, singing sensation, or we're seeing, you know, what's happening with Britney Spears, or, you know, things like that, because that's the quick and easy way to do reporting, and there's not enough reporters left, and media companies aren't interested in printing and broadcasting these bigger stories. And there's one other thing that's interesting about that. When you have media corporations that own media outlets but also own other things, that becomes a problem.
It does.
So you might have GE, who owns vast media holdings, but also creates weapons for war. And so we're supposed to feel like we're going to get objective, hard-hitting reporting from a media company that also has a vested interest in profiting off of war.
I believe NBC isn't NBC owned by GE?
You know, I'd have to check to make sure I would say if that was accurate or not.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, that's another big component. But just stepping back a little bit to what I mentioned about the internet and a lot of publications transitioning online, one of the things that we're also facing in the U.S. is a massive digital divide. And when I say
A
digital divide.
Yes.
About 40% of the country does not have access to the internet, which is so crazy to think about for people who rely on it every day and think, and you know, don't think twice about it. I know that I don't. And you know, I am on the internet all day long, and it's at my fingertips. Whether I want to look up a politician's campaign spending, or I just want to do a quick Google check on a movie I want to watch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very easy for me. But for millions of Americans, it's completely out of their reach, and they're either stuck on dial-up internet, which, if you remember, that screechy kind of noise, that dial-up noise that we used to have in the very beginning of getting onto the internet when it was pretty exciting.
And well, very slow.
Right, very slow. Millions of people are stuck on that, and unfortunately, so many of the applications online require a high-speed connection, so they definitely won't be watching any, you know, Obama speeches online the way the rest of us can.
Do you think that was part of the reason that Obama was focusing on the internet early on in his presidency? And then, of course, we haven't heard anything about that since he's gotten so darn busy, poor thing. But he really seemed to be bringing up that subject early on, and he didn't get a very good reception with it. Was that part of it?
Well, actually, yeah. I mean, the exciting thing about Obama is that for the first time we have a president talking about broadband issues, high-speed internet issues, and really equating that to getting jobs for people, quality of life issues, the importance for our national security. And it was really amazing to see. And he, in his kind of during his campaign, promised that he would try to connect all Americans. And actually, he has been moving forward on that. In the economic stimulus package, they have set aside $7.2 billion for broadband expansion in the U.S., which is a big sum of money. It's not everything we need by any means, but it's just the beginning, and it's a good start to starting to build the infrastructure to connect the rural areas that are completely, you know, left behind, and then some of the urban areas as well. You know, there are multiple reasons why people can't get connected, whether they can't afford it. It's incredibly expensive. You know, $50 a month, who can afford that in these really hard economic times? And that's an average. It could be more or less depending on where you live.
I came from an area actually where there was no high speed available at all. And to be able to have high speed, and I lived up in the mountains in the Sierra Nevadas, to be able to have high speed, you needed to have equipment that cost about $400. You could get satellite high speed. That was the only thing that was available.
Exactly.
And this so it was a real challenge.
This last year, I had the great opportunity to travel to a couple of communities to put together a documentary videos about the digital divide. What does it actually mean to not be connected to the Internet? And in rural North Carolina, most people there have the option of dial-up or satellite. And and often people think, well, okay, at least they have satellite, but satellite is incredibly expensive, and it can be very unreliable.
If it snowed, it didn't work anymore, and it snowed all winter.
So what did you do for your Internet?
We had dial-up.
And how did that affect you?
It was very difficult. We didn't use the Internet as much as we would like to at all. We had about half use. We couldn't, of course, download anything, and it was fantastically slow. So it was usable, but only on a very low level. And I don't know sometimes if Americans think about the fact of how important information is to us, because to be able to have a democracy, you must have informed voters, because voters cannot vote in their own interest if they don't know what their own best interest is. And so getting that information out to Americans and having informed voters is actually incredibly important, because when we get our news from sources where the main fuel for a particular story is ratings, and that's such a difficulty that we have right now, we get our news from shows who are incredibly interested in their ratings, and they're much less interested in fact. And so we end up with voters whose minds are filled with dogma, and how are they going to vote the way that they've been trained on television. And so it is fantastically important.
Which we see a lot on Fox News, the sound bites and the caricatures sometimes. There's no depth or analysis and no opportunity.
That's one that's run amok.
Yes, definitely.
That's just one extreme example.
I heard a really good quote recently. It was this: misinformation is killing this nation. I thought that was fantastic.
It is so true.
It is so true.
So Internet really is important.
One of the things that's also sad is that for people who are offline, it also means they can't organize and speak out in the same ways that others can. The
good
amazing
point.
Thing about the Internet is so many social justice causes, grassroots causes for various things have popped up on the Internet, and that's been so amazing. You know, whether people are know, putting it on their Facebook status or they're writing their own blog, because they've decided that the mainstream media is not covering the issues that they want, is not showing their own voice, and is ignoring important issues. So they can go to the Internet and start to organize and see other social causes, connect with each other, and actually work to make powerful social change. And for people who aren't connected, it's just another way that they're disenfranchised. And it's very sad.
Yeah, that makes good sense.
So, you know, so at Free Press, one of the things that we're working on, we've created a website called internetforeveryone.org. And basically, we have been holding a couple of town hall meetings at various places across the country to hold a conversation with people about what is it that we want from our Internet future. What type of access do we want to have? How are we going to deal with these high prices that are stopping people from getting online? What are some of the barriers to access that are stopping people from being able to get online in your community? And then what should we do? And we're going to take these recommendations to the government and say, here's what the public is saying, and we really need a national broadband plan. Our Internet in the U.S., you know, we're the birthplace of the Internet, and we think of ourselves as a bastion of innovation. But our Internet is actually slower than a lot of other countries, and it's more expensive than other countries. And we're falling tragically behind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, pretty soon we're not going to be able to compete if we don't start dealing with it.
Now, Megan, are you targeting certain committees, or where are these windows of opportunities to speak?
Well, the windows of opportunity are, there are three agencies that have been tasked with dealing with the $7.2 billion for broadband expansion. And right now, the Federal Communications Commission is taking comments about the kind of create how to spend this money. And so we are kind of channeling some of our comments that way so that they know how we want this money to be spent. And we're also going to be kind of creating what we feel is our own national broadband plan and putting that before Congress and before Obama. So we're working on that right now.
Great.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
And we spoke a little bit on the phone about net neutrality.
Sure.
And can you explain that a little bit?
Sure. When you first start talking about net neutrality, it sounds super wonky, so I hope nobody kind of goes off, because it's a really, really important issue, and it's actually one of the issues that I think is the most important right now. Net neutrality is basically the principle, the guiding principle of the Internet that preserves the free and open Internet. Right now, everyone is on a completely equal playing field on the Internet. And we have no other mediums where that is like that. You know, for someone who wants to start their own newspaper, there's an incredible amount of buy-in they have to have in order to get their viewpoints out to the world.
If you mean financial backing.
Mm-hmm. Financial, exactly. And, you know, we did just talk about the digital divide. Yes, there are millions of people who can't get online. But still, the Internet is one of the cheapest vehicles for people to get online and get across their own viewpoint. However, there are Internet service providers, basically big telephone and cable companies, who want to change this. They want to be the Internet gatekeepers and decide which websites go fast or slow and which ones won't load at all. So they want to get rid of this principle of network neutrality. And I think it's best to think about it in terms of this analogy. The Internet is kind of like a superhighway. And all the lanes are traveling right now at the same speed, which means my blog is going to load as fast as Google or any other website, regardless of how much money they have. What the phone and cable companies would like to do is put in tolls where you would have to almost stop and pay extra money to get your content to load, to continue to load fast. Now, I'm not going to be able to pay that money, which means my content is going to start loading slowly, and Google is going to just go right on past me. So if someone starts to want to look for my content online, my content is not going to load very quickly, whereas somebody else's might load much more fast, and I won't be able to compete anymore. And that's very dangerous for, you know, a lot of the social causes that we just talked about. Small startups, blogs, that won't be able to pay that type of money to get their content to load quickly.
So right now we have a window of opportunity where, for instance, if I have a particular idea, I'm an activist, right. I can open up a blog, I can start basically a grassroots movement right. using a lot of time, but not a lot of money. And that really is incredibly powerful, because if you think about it, there has never been a time in human history where one person was able to make an impact like that. I mean, if you think about 30 years ago, if you wanted to start a grassroots movement, you'd get out, you'd have to send mail, you'd call people on the telephone. You know, it would take you a huge amount of time. And so now this gives power to people. Mm-hmm. And it seems like every time people get power, they want to take it away. Someone wants to take it away. And so that would be terrible.
Well, it is very low cost, and it's easily accessible, and it can be potentially, the ideas may be contrary to.
Would they be able to get away with that without us really knowing about it?
Net neutrality?
Uh-huh.
Well, what do you have to say, Megan?
not necessarily. There have been attempts by some of the internet service providers to try to block content online. And last year, Comcast actually tried to do that, but they were caught, and actually Free Press helped to lead the charge against them, and the FCC ruled that they needed to immediately stop doing that. But what we want to see happen is for Congress to mandate net neutrality. Right now, it's more of a principle, and we want to see it completely safeguarded, so that there is no gray room, there is no wiggle room. There's some internet service providers who start to do it, and then they get slapped on the wrist. We don't want that at all. And so that's one of the things that we're also working on at one of our campaigns called SaveTheInternet.com. Mm-hmm. And so for people who are interested in that issue, they can go there, read more about it, and get plugged in that way.
That's an incredibly important subject.
It really, really is.
Everyone needs to support that.
And there isn't enough information out about it. Mm-hmm. And the sooner this legislation gets put into effect.
Because the other thing they'll do is chip away at it little by little by little. As much as they can get away with, they will. And then they'll get away with a little bit more. And having a voice for people to be able to have a voice is so incredibly important.
Right.
Again, with just having a democracy and having informed voters and getting good information out there, being able to look after our own interests and not the interests of corporations.
Exactly. And even for people who aren't necessarily politically plugged in that are listening, let's say that you're simply tired of the same sitcoms that you're seeing on cable TV anymore, the same things that you're seeing over and over again. The amazing thing about the internet is that we have all this these user-generated content that is happening now. You know, you can go to websites like Blip TV, and we've got alternative programming for the first time where we're not having to rely on really kind of like white men in suits to decide what it is that we're going to watch and when. The public really gets to decide. So whether you're in it for entertainment reasons or you're in it for social justice reasons or you know, whatever it is, the fight is really important.
And that's true of local radio, too. The airwaves have become so commercialized. We're fortunate in Santa Cruz to have two public radio stations and, of course, free radio.
And I think most Americans, when they get their news just from either network news or cable news, because you hear someone in a suit make a particular statement, you think that that's going to be really the truth. But when you back away from it a little bit, you realize that there's ratings involved. Sensationalized news. Obviously, the biggest cable news, the most popular cable news show is the most sensationalized cable news show. That's Bill O'Reilly's show that there is out there on the air. And so people will listen to that and think that it's fact. And so it's difficult for us to get stories, get the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. That seems to be challenging these days, and we know that it's because those finances are back there. You know, they're wanting to make money and stirring that all up with the news that we kind of get a product that's really definitely less than second rate.
Of our airwaves, of our newspapers, the print media, and now the internet, that's being threatened.
That's our last bastion of freedom.
Exactly. Right. And Cynthia, when you mentioned radio stations, another thing that's actually been happening today, which is pretty exciting, is there is a big fight happening right now for low-power FM radio stations.
And what's that?
And low-power FM radio stations are non-commercial local community radio stations. And they're licensed to not-for-profit community organizations. And today, this very day, people from across the country met in Washington to support a new bill. It's called the Local Community Radio Act. And this bill will open up lots of space on the spectrum for hundreds, maybe even thousands of new community radio stations. And this would just be amazing for communities who have really been shut out by the mainstream media. Maybe their local newspapers are shutting down. Their local news is not being covered anymore because so much of radio is completely concentrated and owned, again, by several corporations who run the same playlists of the same songs, mm-hmm. And you'll hear the same things, whether you're driving in, you know, Massachusetts, where I live, or California. You know, it used to be you could drive across country and know where you were depending on what was on the radio.
The flavor of each community, that's for sure. Each region had its own flavor. That's gone.
It's completely disappeared, and it's so unfortunate.
And also, I've noticed on KR local public radio stations, often NPR is syndicated in, and that's very similar wherever you are across the country. If you tune into a public radio station, it's often NPR, which sometimes they have great programs, but still you're losing that unique flavor of each community where the information is often very important that needs to get out, and there's no way for it to reach anyone.
Exactly. So, you know, it's stifled so many different things. You can think about information about emergencies. You know, you have different communities that may be facing hurricanes or other situations where the local community needs to be told up-to-the-minute information about what's happening for their safety. But often the radio stations don't have anyone at home. They're being broadcast from miles and miles away, and who have no idea what's actually happening in the local community and can't feed those people's needs. And it can be dire in some situations.
And also just discussing local issues and concerns. There's no forum for that. And different meetings that are taking place, council meetings or ad hoc committees that are meeting somewhere. We have a newspaper, a few local entertainment weeklies, but there is free radio, which you're on right now, but our reach is not very far.
Right. And even, you know, how hard is it for a local musician to get on the air these days? It's nearly impossible, because you know, you've got to have the right look, the right contact, and the right music that's chosen by, you know,
preordained,
exactly. So it means all the music starts sounding the same, because it is. And, you know, it really, you know, stifles innovation in music, in talk radio, and, again, and really delving deep into the issues that concern local people. And that's just really, it's really frightening and it's really sad.
And how can you have a democracy without a flourishing media? You really can't. People aren't informed. They don't know what's really going on in terms of the issue. There's no analysis. There's no opportunity to go beyond the sound bites.
Yeah, you're exactly right. One of the things that's been particularly troubling is that there's been a mass exodus of journalists from D.C. And it's interesting because, you know, we have one of the biggest, you know, public spending plans that we have ever had going on. We have, you know, a changing of the guard happening. We have so many different things happening in D.C., and we need all of these haystacks looked under. And
certainly
yet
do.
We have reporters that aren't there anymore. And it doesn't seem to matter whether these reporters were award-winning and were actually really doing their job or not. They've been pulled because their budgets have been
flat. Considered expendable, right?
And yet they're considered expendable.
And they have years as journalists.
And they've just been let go. And so not only is it bad on a national scale, thinking about, okay, our federal government, they're not being looked at, but also from a local scale, there were a lot of regional reporters in D.C. who were covering politics from a local angle for their community back home. And those people have been pulled, which means, you know, a reporter looking at how is this bill going to affect farmers? How is this bill going to affect, you know, women in my town? There's no one doing that anymore. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, is very troubling. And coming full circle, that's, again, you read in the very beginning a snippet from our policy director, Ben Scott, from testimony he gave before Congress this week. And what we're doing now is really saying we have to start looking at this journalism crisis immediately. And we need to create a national journalism strategy. And while this problem is urgent, we don't necessarily need to do things haphazardly. We need to start looking for a lot of different answers for mm-hmm. how we can support quality journalism and definitely not prop up these old business models that mm-hmm. have both failed financially and completely, utterly failed the public.
Does it seem like part of that question would be awakening the public to the fact that potentially they aren't getting the good news, the good quality news? It doesn't seem like people really realize that there is a gap beginning to happen. They don't really appreciate how integral journalism is to democracy. That aspect mm-hmm. of our system, you know, democracy is people having power. But if people are uninformed or don't know, they don't have power. You have to have, you know, knowledge is power. So if you know what's going on, you have the power to stand up for yourself, to be a part of the system, a positive part. But it seems like today people are really disconnected from that concept. They seem really happy to, you know, just get their news at 5 o'clock. And I'll tell you, in this current situation, people have quit watching the news, which is even, you know, disconcerting. But coming out from a time really of prosperity and things were going really well in the last 5 years, you know, you kind of get complacent and you don't really think about things like that. But with this new crisis and, you know, the situation in the world currently, hopefully people will become more aware of the fact that they play a really important part. You know, we're integral. You know, the president of the United States is the most powerful person in the world. But American public opinion is actually more powerful than he is. And that's you and me. And so we actually do have that power. And hopefully in this new situation, we'll become more connected to that and more aware of it and more active. Do you find that people are seeming to be more alert to that now, even in the face of the difficulties in journalism?
I do feel like people are beginning to wake up a little bit and look around and start questioning what is going on. And not just what is going on with the media, but why is that happening?
Mm-hmm. And the media failed in its watchdog role of right. really reporting what was going on. They mm-hmm. didn't ask the questions that needed to be asked.
Mm-hmm. Over and over again, whether you're looking at, you know, the war in Iraq or you're looking at
the
current financial crisis, you know, mm-hmm. it's happened over and over again. So I think that we're facing a really unique opportunity now where, you know, unfortunately, terrible things have happened and, mm-hmm. You know, people have lost their jobs. And I think that people are finally starting to say, well, hold on. Mm-hmm. Why didn't we know that this was coming? And this gives us a unique opportunity to right. say it's because we have a very systemic problem in our media system.
Mm-hmm.
It's
we
failing
do.
Us over and over again.
Yeah.
And it has to stop and it has to change. You know, you are right that the problem that we face is that even still, big media, as I like to call it, has a stranglehold on so mm-hmm. much of our media outlets that they can continue to kind of desensitize us and kind of...
tell us what they want us to hear.
Yeah, and lull
gossip
us to
and
sleep a little bit and say, don't worry, it's fine, you know, you don't need to go any farther than this to get your information. This is all you need to know. And so what we need to do in the face of that is just keep yelling. And we need more and more mm-hmm. voices to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Free Press has 500,000 members, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
That's 500,000 people who understand how media is so crucial to everything. but we need more people involved, and we need people telling everyone they know. And I like to say that if, you know, in the environment is your first issue, if women's rights or gay rights is your first issue, then media should be your second, because mm-hmm. it underpins
it does
so many other
Absolutely.
Things.
Yes.
And if you care, if you know you're on Earth Day and you're like, the world is just, you know, it's just falling apart, and we've got to start looking at climate change. Well, you've actually got to start looking at the media, because the media is failing to talk about climate change in any real way.
There's you just get a superficial account on Earth Day, which we just had, but
it seems like the more progress that we make in making a dent and helping people understand global warming and those kinds of things, the more the other side screams that global warming is a hoax.
Right.
I've seen more and more posts. I blog a lot, and I've seen more and more posts recently coming up saying, oh, there you go with that stupid global warming baloney again. You know, it's just another ice age coming. Man has absolutely nothing to do with anything that's happening on the planet. We can behave any way that we want to, and, you know, no detrimental effect will come from that. And it's so distressing when I see that, and I know it's because they've gotten a really bad piece of information. They're being indoctrinated into a particular line of thinking, and of course, we're stuck on the planet with that. And so that becomes really dangerous to us in our own future, so it's really important. Yeah, it seems like they amp up their side. So you're right, we just have to keep yelling louder and louder. And just never give up until we come to some kind of fruit out of it. It seems like now, too, people really want to have power. People in America, it seems like, feel really powerless right now, and they want to have power. They want to have a say. And so that's there, but it seems like people don't really quite know that they really do have power.
And we have amazing power, and we have already, you know, it's easy to dwell on things are hard and scary, but we have already made or gotten such big victories, even just this last week. Here's an example of where the grassroots voice, the public voice, stopped a giant corporation. Time Warner Cable is trying to roll out a new plan, a new tiered billing plan, in four different areas across the United States, where it would charge their internet users an exorbitant amount of money to get completely unlimited access to the internet. They basically want to start charging people a certain amount of money depending on how much bandwidth they use.
And I saw something about that. It was terrifying.
Yes. So, you know, I am definitely not going crazy on the internet, but I'm definitely, you know, I'm on there, I'm watching a couple of videos, and they would limit the amount of bandwidth I use, or I would have to pay up to $150 a month to basically use the same amount I pay $50 for now.
So you'd
There's
actually
no way I can afford that.
It makes the library computers look really enticing, doesn't it?
Oh,
everyone
would
be
watch.
Flooding to the library to get on the internet.
Exactly, but
then you only have an hour. That's limited,
right?
Too.
That's true.
So right. That would that's a problem.
So that would would actually limit the amount of time that you had, and also diminish the speed
by your finances.
Is that what the tiered plan would?
Oh, right. So it would limit. So let's say you have a tier where you're not getting as much bandwidth as you normally did, and suddenly you have gone over your amount of bandwidth, and you don't even necessarily know you've done it, and you just keep using the internet like you normally do, and you suddenly get a bill, and you've been penalized for the amount that you've gone over your bandwidth.
Oh, that's just what we need.
The
so think
rate
about it like
would
a
be
cell
increased
phone bill
dramatically.
Where you accidentally go over your minutes, and you get your bill, and you're like, oh my God, how am I going to pay
You get that thick
this?
Bill, and you know it's a big, huge, thick bill, and you don't even want to open it.
Find out how many more bandwidths you have.
And the interesting thing about this is that these Time Warner Cable and other cable companies are in the internet business, but they're also in the cable business. And mm-hmm. what's happening is that people are transitioning away from watching mm-hmm. cable television mm-hmm. to watching online videos.
And that's very threatening mm-hmm. to them.
Very threatening. So when you cut off the bandwidth, you cut off the amount of online video people can watch, and you stifle your competition immediately.
It's annoying to realize that companies are full-time trying to figure out how to suck money out of us.
Always.
Exactly.
Always.
It's total price gouging at its worst. And the public realized this
mm-hmm.
and said, no, we're not going to take this. There mm-hmm. were several protests. There was just, you know, people flooding, calling them. There were lots of blogs up. There's this amazing blog called StopTheCaps.com.
Stop
the what?
Stop the Caps.
Okay. C-A-P-S.
Mm-hmm. C-A-P-S, because this is called a internet cap. They're okay. capping our use.
Yeah.
And Time Warner Cable last week said, okay, we're going to shelve this plan.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really big victory to see that we were able to do this. And we were also able to start getting congressional support as they say, you know what, we're going to investigate this sort of pricing because this doesn't seem right.
Oh, so Congress stood up for us? Is that what you're saying?
There were actually two Congress members who came out.
And who's that?
In support of the opposition.
Who was that? Do you know?
It was Representative Massa, and let me get the other one. I believe it was Senator, I don't want to say his name wrong, so let me be sure to get it right for you.
They need to be encouraged, thanked.
Okay,
that's
a good
idea.
Senator Charles Schumer.
Charles Schumer?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Senator Schumer from Rochester.
Mm-hmm.
New York.
And Representative Massa. M-A-S-S-A, Eric Massa.
Where he's from.
So fantastic.
That is, you know, so we should all be heartened by that. Of course, we have to remain vigilant because these cable companies don't go away for long. They're like that. You know that game that you play where you're hitting the little hedgehog things that
mm-hmm.
pop up over
yes.
and over again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they shelved it until we weren't looking, right? They're just waiting until we're not paying attention.
It pops up again.
They've launched a re-education plan to try to dupe the public into thinking this must be in our best interest.
Oh boy!
And we just have to remain vigilant mm-hmm. and continue to do what we did before, mm-hmm. but bring in more people
mm-hmm.
and say, you know, we won't stand for this because already we can't afford our internet.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to deal with mm-hmm. this, and then we have mm-hmm. to deal with that problem.
Well, it does seem like a subject that anyone across the board, it's a really nonpartisan subject. I mean, any American across the board would agree. They're just not going to take that.
They have an interesting way of framing, mm-hmm. though, oftentimes.
They definitely
I've
do.
I've noticed that, I mean, when I say they, mm-hmm. I mean some of the more large media lobbyists.
Sure. That's why they call it spin, though. They take the truth and they go 180, and then they use it, and then they say that's the truth. So.
And so many decisions are made behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm. That's why your work is so important, too, because it grounds us to what's really happening. It's so valuable to have the whole truth and nothing but the truth. So we really thank you
there
for that.
Seeing what's going on behind mm-hmm. the closed doors.
Yeah, definitely.
Great work.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And how can we get more involved? And I know that you have a packet of information, and that's probably on your webpage, freepress.net.
Exactly.
Not
freepress.net. Mm-hmm. And you can go there to get involved and to read more information about different media issues. See what kind of reverberates with you and your interests. You can actually join and sign up for action alerts and become a member who gets, you know, email updates when we need petitions signed or we need you to start calling your congressperson or your representative.
Mm-hmm.
So I definitely urge everyone to go to freepress.net. We have several other websites where we run campaigns, and we have blogs on those sites. We have stopbigmedia.com.
Stopbigmedia.com.
And that's for anyone who's interested in the aspects of media consolidation, how it has hurt our journalism, how it's stifled people's voices. And, you know, we have a tiny portion of women and people of color owning the media, which is just, it's absurd. So if you're interested in that issue, it's stopbigmedia.com. We have savetheinternet.com. So again, those issues about net neutrality, Time Warner Cable, and this ridiculous price gouging, you can go to that website to find out more. And we also have internetforeveryone.org. So going back to the digital divide issues we talked about, trying to get everyone in the U.S. connected online, because it actually benefits all of us to have a connected nation.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing to think that corporations believe that they can lie enough that they could finally get Americans to go along with something that's detrimental to Americans.
Yeah.
So that kind of demonstrates that that's something that is doable, or they wouldn't be, you know, potentially thinking about how they could keep this on the shelf and, you know, keep it. That's not a policy that's helpful to any normal citizen, it sounds like to me.
Right.
And so it's amazing that corporations believe that they have that much power that they could shelve it and maybe play with things a little and people finally go along with it eventually. That's scary. Good thing for you guys. Good thing that we have you guys watching our backs that way.
Right. Well, we're only as powerful as our grassroots, you know, network behind us. So, you know, the great thing is, you know, we fire off an outreach and we have people who respond.
Uh-huh.
And we had 16,000 people in the couple of days that we launched a kind of attack against Time Warner Cable that came out and signed a petition for Congress to start investigating them. And that's really amazing.
We're so lucky to live in a democracy. In a place where we can do that.
It's threatened, though.
Yes, it
by
is.
By this media consolidation.
Quote-unquote democracy, I should say. Trying to be a democracy. But we're lucky to even have the amount of power that we do have.
It's true.
So,
it's true. We still do have the internet.
Uh-huh.
With a lot of
It's good to be able to exercise
continual.
That today. Yeah.
Definitely.
Work to keep it reformed, open and free.
Exactly. And there are multiple ways right now that we can and make sure that we can safeguard that, whether it's, you know, the low-power radio station bill that is currently being looked at right now. Thousands of communities could get a low-power radio station, and that would be just, you know, totally transformational for so many places.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So that would be potentially user-generated radio. In a bigger sense. So if you live in a particular community and you really like a particular genre of music, but there is no radio station that carries that genre, you could potentially have an hour show on a program like on a
Which
station
is
like that, possibly.
Right here at Free Radio Santa Cruz,
mm-hmm.
too, and at the university, possibly.
Right.
And in San Francisco, there's KPFA, part of the Pacifica mm-hmm. organization, and they do a great service.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
And generate a lot of quality programs in depth.
Definitely. It's so
We're
important
fortunate.
Whether you're wanting to talk about, you know, a health issue or you're giving a show to young people who, you know, are incredibly marginalized in our media.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the great things about community radio, community media, is that it allows people who are being stereotyped in the mainstream media
mm-hmm.
and their voices are being left out, and they can finally, you know, talk about their own issues rather than having someone else report it for them in a way that doesn't reflect what's actually happening and just kind of plays into these negative norms
mm-hmm.
and these negative
mm-hmm.
stereotypes that continue to disenfranchise people and put their communities
mm-hmm.
down.
And yet there is such a cry, such a need right now for people to act. I mean, I'm seeing that more and more, and I watched appalled as Fox News recently was able to channel that rage into these tea parties.
I know.
So you can really
that was
see
just
there
the power of the media.
Uh-huh. In a short just picture, the power of
in three months
since Obama has been in office. You know, particular stations have really hit the anti-Obama, you know, gong over and over. And so within 3 months, they have people. Now, I can't remember in my history people of that political party protesting. You know,
I'm
normally
Republican.
that you know, who it was particularly set up by. You don't usually see people like that protesting. It's usually the other side that's protesting. So it shows that that really is an incredible power, that you could get that many people that disenfranchised that quickly. You know, and then again, there's all kinds of questions you can ask around that. Like, for instance, you know, what would you have done with the economy instead of what we are doing? You know, I don't know if their gripe was really quite as insane as it came off, you know, but that's a whole other subject for another radio show. And but it does show the power of that media, and it is really fascinating, kind of scary.
One of the things that we have to remember isn't that there wasn't necessarily a vast number of people out there.
Now, I heard Huckabee say it was 6 million.
Well, you know, the thing is, we have to also think about the media companies and the broadcast stations who are reporting
prone to exaggerate
just a little.
And I think it was regardless of whether you're for or against, or how you feel about the economic stimulus package, or the the Tea Party's the Tea protest. You know, the thing to really look at is the media has amazing amount of power.
Huge power.
And they can not only mobilize people, but they can decide how they report it, when they report it, what it looks like, what it sounds like.
And if we're not careful, they can decide elections.
And that's where our vigilance, and that's why our vigilance is so important. And Megan, unfortunately, our time is up. It's time for Palestinian news. But you are so well informed and articulate, and I really thank you for taking the time to come on and speak with us. I didn't ask any listeners to call in because you had so much to say. I wanted to hear what you had to say.
Wonderful.
And we'll invite you on again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Yep, good luck
thank
with everything.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks again. Bye-bye. All right, now it's time for Palestinian news.
This is David Barsamyan of Alternative Radio, inviting you to tune in for Alternative Radio on Free Radio Santa Cruz, Wednesday mornings at 9, 101 FM.
And be sure to tune in to Bathrop's Pier's Broadsides. That's with me, Robert North, on 101.1 FM and www.freakradio.org every Thursday night, 6 to 8 p.m. And, of course, every Sunday morning from 9:30 all the way to 1 p.m. if you're game.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, Sick Around America, the recently aired documentary on PBS's Frontline, purported to ask why the U.S. can't finance universal health care the way other developed countries do. But the picture was at best incomplete, since it seems some options were considered off the table. We'll hear from reporter and author T.R. Reid, who worked on Sick Around America as a follow-up to his Sick Around the World from last year, but who disassociated himself from the domestic version when he saw what producers had done with it. What was wrong? We'll find out. Also on the show, a landmark essay in the New York Review of Books details U.S. torture of detainees through Red Cross interviews with the detainees themselves. Mark Danner's powerful piece raises questions about how a society that claims to seek justice can look the other way when faced with evidence that high officials are apparently ordering heinous crimes. We'll talk to Mark Danner about the Red Cross report and what it means. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
Washington Post columnist George Will, the most syndicated columnist in the United States, came under fire in February for spreading misinformation about climate change. Not one to be intimidated by facts, Will came back with another column on April 2nd, peddling similar pseudoscience. Will wrote, quote, "Reducing carbon emissions supposedly will reverse warming, which is allegedly occurring even though, according to statistics published by the World Meteorological Organization, there has not been a warmer year on record than 1998, close quote. Citing the temperature of a single year as a disproof of climate change is, intellectually speaking, about one step above pointing at an April snowstorm as evidence that the world isn't getting warmer. 1998, the year Will cites, is the hottest year on record, but the last 13 years have included all 11 of history's hottest years, a clear trend that is just part of the evidence that has led an overwhelming majority of climate scientists to conclude that human activity is causing the global temperature to rise. The Washington Post claims to have a fact-checking process in place to catch errors by its columnists. Will's repeated trumpeting of bogus climate science makes it clear, though, that the Post thinks its columnists are entitled to their own opinions and to their own facts.
ABC's Good Morning America aired a three-part series, Black and White Now, to look at race relations in America. The series, running from March 31st through April 2nd, revisited some old experiments and stories about race. One story found that children playing with black and white dolls no longer tend to respond as negatively to the black dolls as was found in the 1940s, though some black girls still say the black doll is ugly and the white doll pretty. Another segment revisited the story of black men trying to hail cabs in New York City. This time, ABC's non-scientific survey found black men did fine during the day, but had a harder time getting a cab once it was dark out. And the final report had Good Morning America anchors Diane Sawyer and Robin Roberts going back to their hometowns in the South to talk to...
Beach Radio News.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, April 23rd, 2009. Clashes erupt between Arab villagers and Israeli police in Israel over house demolition, and the military kidnaps more civilians from the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. During clashes on Wednesday night between the residents of the Arab village of Kfar Qasim in the Galilee, 5 soldiers were injured and 20 local youth were arrested. Local sources said that Israeli police, accompanied by soldiers and bulldozers, stormed the village to demolish a home there on Wednesday. Violent clashes took place lasting till Thursday morning. Witnesses reported that troops demolished the house and arrested 20 men. The villagers say the Israeli authorities denied them permission to build homes there. In the West Bank, 8 Palestinian civilians were kidnapped on Thursday during Israeli military invasions targeting a number of communities. Palestinian sources said the invasion took place in Hebron, Bethlehem, southern West Bank, in addition to Nablus and Jenin in the north. Also in Bethlehem, the Israeli military issued orders on Thursday to stop the preparation work for the Bob's visit in Aida refugee camp located in the city. The refugee camp welcoming committee for the Bob's visit said Israeli troops stormed the camp, instructing the workers to stop, claiming that the camp is under military control and that any work there requires the army's permission. Aida refugee camp located in Bethlehem city, where the Israeli wall separating Bethlehem from Jerusalem. Bethlehem is under the full control of the Palestinian Authority. The Bob is expected to visit Bethlehem and stop by the Aida refugee camp in mid-May as part of his visit to Palestine. Thank you for joining us from Occupy Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you by Ghassan Badnoura and George Ishmawi.
From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, the 23rd of April, 2009. High-ranking Bush administration officials ignored warnings.